From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Tariq Gross with Fresh Air. Happy Thanksgiving. On this edition of Fresh Air, writing TV comedies. Larry Gelbart talks about being part of the neurotic, egotistical, and sometimes violent comedy team writing for Sid Caesar. The team included Mel Brooks, Carl Reiner, and Neil Simon. Gelbart went on to develop MASH for television. And as the official Christmas shopping season begins, we'll hear from TV's most famous salesman, Ron Popeil. He's built a fortune hawking such products as the Vegematic and Mr. Microphone. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the new CD by mezzo-soprano Cecilia Bartoli, a collection of 19th and 20th century French songs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On January 28th, the Writers Guild of America will pay tribute to Larry Gelbart, our guest on today's show. Gelbart was on the writing team for Sid Caesar from 1955 to 58, along with Neil Simon, Mel Brooks, and Carl Reiner. You may have seen them on the PBS series Caesar's Writers, which will be rebroadcast in December on many PBS stations. Gelbart later developed the TV series MASH and served as its principal writer, and wrote the screenplays for Oh God, Tootsie, and Barbarians at the Gate. He wrote the book for the Stephen Sondheim musical A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which is now revived on Broadway. To get an idea of what Caesar's shows were like, here's a sketch with Carl Reiner as a roving reporter interviewing the famous Viennese sleep expert Dr. Sigmund von Sedative, played by Sid Caesar.
Doctor, I wonder if you can show us your own personal method for falling asleep.
Of course, that's all. See, most of the people, they walk in when they, you know, they just get into bed very gently, you know? My method, you come in the bed, you flop into bed. You flop into bed and you relax everything. Well, then you concentrate. You concentrate, you say, all right, toes, good night. Good night, toes, come on, go to sleep. When you see right away, they curl up and they drop off. to sleep, they drop off to sleep. Well, then you say, good night, ankles. Good night, knees. I'm pretty sure you see the legs are asleep. When you tell the stomach, come on, good night, stop the mixing in there. Go to sleep. When you tell the chest, you did a nice job today. You did work good. Stop the breathing. Come on. When you tell the throat, come on, okay, stop that. All right, brain, come on, go to sleep. Brain, will you please go to sleep? Come on, everybody else is sleeping. Why don't you? Listen, don't holler so loud, will you please? You'll wake up the stomach. Will you please go to sleep like a night? I got a brain inside of his mind. Will you please go to sleep again? Well, don't holler so much, will you please? You'll wake up the whole... You don't want to go to sleep, huh? You don't want to go to sleep? All right. I got it. All right, everybody up! Everybody. Someday you want to go to sleep, I wouldn't let you sleep. Now, what are you...
I asked Larry Gelbart to recall one of his favorite Sid Caesar sketches, and he described a takeoff of Hollywood musicals about three sailors on leave who meet three waitresses who turn out to be heiresses.
Well, Carl Reiner, Howie Morris, and Sid Caesar, of course, played the three sailors who arrive in New York on a 24-hour shore leave and just get involved in really all the movie cliches about meeting girls, falling in love, not being able to get back to the ship, hokey romance, bogus tap numbers, original songs. And I remember it culminated with them all getting married on the battleship and the admiral coming out and saying, as you know, we always do a big production number on our deck before we go off to war. And we did do a big production number. I guess it must be a favorite because it's the first one that sort of spun around on the wheel decks of my mind when you asked that question.
Do you remember the lyrics to the songs?
Oh, something about uptown's up and downtown's down and east side's on the east side and the west side's. I mean, they were just, you know, Cod, Compton and Green, right. Or Compton and Green, if you want.
Right. Now, what was it like writing for the Sid Caesar show as a group? Was it a collective process?
it was a totally collective process. We were all locked in the same room together every Monday morning from 10 o'clock until 6. On a Monday morning, we say, well, what do we do this Saturday night? And we, by Wednesday, we had written an hour show that would have been one or two or three or four sketches, perhaps a mime routine, perhaps some special musical material. And by Thursday, Sid was in the rehearsal hall with the performers rehearsing the material, and it was broadcast live, that is to say, in front of an audience, without laugh machines, without tape machines, without any, you know, mechanical help. By Saturday night at around 10 o'clock, it was all over. We had Sunday to relax and to either enjoy or regret what we had done on Saturday night. And then Monday, it started all over again. But there we were, all in the same room, pitching jokes like crazy. Neil Simon captured it amazingly accurately and affectionately in a play he did a couple of years ago called Laughter on the 23rd Floor.
In an article in the New York Times a bunch of years ago, you described the writing room as supercharged, marvelously competitive, and literally violent. I'd like to hear about the violence.
Everybody wants to hear about the violence. A lot of the violence was directed at Mel Brooks. Mel, God bless him, I believe is the proper cliche at this moment. Mel is a vastly unique and talented man. He could not get to work on time. He was always late. And we resented it. And he knew we resented it, but it didn't stop him from being late. And so there were times when we would burn him in effigy.
Literally?
Literally. We would have a hat, a shirt, a jacket, or something of him, set fire to it in this office building in New York City on 57th Street. We would throw... Mel once wrapped me on the bottom of my feet with a ruler. I was sitting up with my feet up on the desk, and for some reason he just smacked me across the bottoms, and they really hurt. And so when I first chance I could get, I threw his shoes out the window. He had taken them off because he was napping or something, and so he had to go downstairs barefoot and buy a new pair of shoes. There was an awful lot of ambivalence in the room, and the negative side of it often, you know, resulted in that kind of violence, although not continuously. And we didn't even have time for that kind of nonsense, truly. But we took a moment or two to vent our collective spleens.
I imagine there was a lot of ego and a lot of neurosis in the room.
Probably more neurosis than ego, because when you're in what amounts to a dugout of writers, you know, a battery of writers, you're punching away. You don't smart because one joke, you know, wasn't accepted by the others. You come up with another one. When there's a good one, fine. That then you're one joke closer to having a sketch written, say. So while we all had healthy egos, what was the other? What was the
neurosis? What was
the, neurosis. Oh, that we were. We were all very neurotic. Very neurotic. I like to think we all still are.
But proud no one of
more.
It.
but no one more neurotic than Sid. I mean, you know, it.
How did Sid Caesar's neurosis get expressed, and how did you deal with it?
Well, Sid was really kind of walking around encased in rage for a lot of years. I mean, he's talked about his own demons. His substance abuse and stuff. I don't want to elaborate on that, but Sid was a mess, and there were times he would come to the office wearing carrying a revolver.
You're kidding.
A Magnum revolver. Yeah.
Like loaded?
He was, and the gun was too. No, Sid did not drink until after 6 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
So we all used to try to get out of there about 5 minutes to six. But Sid had a lot of anger, and you know, Sid was like a refrigerator in a sports jacket. He was a big man. Sid was Mel Brooks used the joke in Blazing Saddles, but once Sid was riding in Central Park, horseback riding in Central Park with his wife Florence, and Florence's horse threw Florence to the ground, and Sid got off his horse and punched Florence's horse right between the eyes, and the horse went down. I mean, we're talking about that kind of strength and violence. that was, you know, set to go off at any second.
So when he would bring his gun to work, would he brandish it at the at the writers? What would he? What
oh
would
no
do
no no he. Sid, there was a time there for a while.
Oh, I know what he'd do. He'd hold the gun to his forehead and say, "Oh," he'd hold out the gun and he'd say, "That those jokes stink. If you want to kill me, use this."
No, he didn't. No, there was a time. Sid went through a paranoid stage where he thought that Otto Skorzeny, the famous Nazi provocateur, was after him.
Oh,
so
gosh.
He was really carrying it in self-defense. Now it becomes understandable, I hope.
Right, that he was having paranoid delusions.
Yeah, that the man was going to surface in a submarine in the East River and come over to 57th Street and get Sid. Sid felt no violence towards us. He really did then and still does have a healthy respect for what we did with and for him.
Well, let me ask you, if he thought that someone was out to get him, who clearly wasn't, did you ever worry about how he was going to perform live on television?
No, Sid, we never worried for one second. The only thing we knew that Sid would not be sure of was being able to say good evening to the audience as Sid Caesar. Once he got into any sketch, any prepared material, once he could do a monologue, once he could do a mime, once he could play a character, he was fine. The only person in the world he did not know how to play was Sid Caesar. He had a neurotic, persistent hack. He would cough. It would be good evening, lady. He could not say good evening, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we worried about. We thought that would be the whole hour, Sid saying good evening.
So would you have him say good evening in somebody else's character just to get him through that?
No. He had to be himself for a second.
Right.
Sid was often not himself when he was off camera. I mean, we talk about it in that session that we had. When we got together, we talk about the fact that for almost a year, Sid spoke with a Polish accent. He pretended to be a Polish janitor, a maintenance man, and that's the way he said good morning, that's the way he had lunch with you, and that's the way he said good night.
Wow, how strange!
So, no kidding.
Was it hard convincing him to do sketches that you really believed in?
No. No, he was a very good judge of material. All really good comedians are very good editors. They recognize what's right for them. They definitely know what's wrong for them. And he was brave. We would do satires based or parodies based on material that was not generally known or widespread, such as Japanese movies. When we did them, hardly anybody in the audience, the television audience, had ever seen a Japanese movie. We did very esoteric things and very brave things, and Sid was the bravest of all because he was the one out there in front of the camera doing it and risking his his reputation and his ability to make people laugh by doing material that was very, very sophisticated.
Carl Reiner often performed on the Sid Caesar Show. Mel Brooks went on to become a performer as well as a writer and director. Were they more extroverted in the writing room because they were performers too?
Yes. We really thought of Carl as an actor, a performer who could also contribute to the writing. We thought of Mel as a very gifted writer who could also perform, but no one was more extroverted than Mel. I mean, Mel was a show. I mean, we really enjoyed Mel when we weren't burning him,
burning him in effigy, right?
Yeah, when we weren't pouring lighter fluid all over his clothes. He's vastly entertaining. He's surprising. Mel has, Charlie Chaplin said, that audiences laugh at two things. One, they laugh when they expect something and it happens. Such as the man approaching the banana peel that they know is there and he doesn't, or when it's a complete surprise. Mel was then and always is a complete surprise. You never know, I'm not sure he does, what he's going to say or do next.
My guest is Larry Gelbart. In the 50s, he wrote for Sid Caesar. He's one of the writers reunited in the program Caesar's Writers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. back with writer Larry Gelbart.
Larry Gelbart, a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, is revived now on Broadway. That must be wonderful for you to have a revival like that.
Well, what's really very rewarding about it is the fact that Bert Shevelov, my co-author, and Stephen Sondheim, who did the score, I mean, we started writing that show 40 years ago. And it's nice to know, you know, that the ink hasn't faded, that it, mm-hmm. that it still works for a modern audience. And this is the third time around, actually. We had it first ran in 1960, opened in 1962, then there was a revival in 72, and now there's this one in 96. So it's third time around, and it's done well every time. So it's a great compliment to us.
Now, a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum is based on the plays of the Roman writer Plautus, who was born in 254 B.C. So this guy wrote a long, long time ago. What's the connection between Plautus and Forum?
Total. We read the 26 plays of his, which still exist, 27 plays of his, which are extant, and we selected a character here, a character there, a bit of a storyline here and another one from another play, and then started adding our own connective tissue and our own Plautine-like complications. So it's a direct line from work that is over 2,000 years old to what they're doing on Broadway today. There is one line in the play which was done in 200 B.C., where Miles Gloriosus, the braggart warrior, says to his admirers, he says, "I am a parade." And it always gets a laugh. Steve worked it into a lyric. And that line, as I said, is about 2,500 years old.
Was Plautus the Roman father of low comedy?
He was the Roman father of low comedy. I got in trouble writing a piece recently for the New York Times in which I said he invented it all. The truth is he adapted a great deal of it from the Greeks, from Menander and others. But he was certainly one of the first people to introduce comic conventions. One would think comedy was always with us, and in fact it has always been with us, but these were people who organized that comedy. They gave us stereotypes. They gave us the henpecked husband. They gave us the moonstruck young lover. They gave us the wily slave, the henpecked husband, and the braggart warrior, and situations, mistaken identities, all sorts of comic conventions which have not been changed or improved upon in two millennia.
You were the principal writer for MASH from 1972 to 1976. You're the guy who developed it from the film. Did it seem to you when you were starting on MASH that a mobile surgical unit in the Korean War was the perfect subject for a TV sitcom?
No. I think it was the perfect setting for a television half hour. I don't think that MASH... I never have thought of it
as a sitcom,
mm-hmm. truly. Mm-hmm. Because of what sitcom has come to mean, you know, the Hello, Honey, I'm Home kind of show.
Laugh.
Three-camera tape, studio show. You know, in a funny way, Forum is more of a sitcom mm-hmm. than MASH is, because all the laughs in that show are situational. They mm-hmm. all derive from situation. No, I just thought that MASH, as a weekly show, could address an area of human behavior that would lend itself to comedy and more, a comedy in a minor key, much as the theme song.
Of Suicide is Painless.
Yeah. But yes, I did think it was going to be something I would enjoy writing.
Did you think of Vietnam as being the subtext when MASH premiered in 1972?
Well, I was kind of able to travel on two mental tracks, to create a very clumsy phrase. I had been in Korea when I worked for Bob Hope. I had gone over there when he entertained the troops. And so I knew Korea. I knew that war. I knew that place. I knew the way it smelled, literally. And so that never left me as I worked on the series, but I was also obviously very, very conscious of the fact that we had the opportunity, the rare opportunity in an entertainment capacity, in the field of entertainment, to comment on this disastrous involvement that our country had in Vietnam.
Do you have a favorite episode?
I think my favorite episode is the least written episode, and that was the one that was sort of my valedictory episode. It was the last episode of the fourth year, and it was called The Interview, and it's in black and white. And it consists of a series of interviews with the actors in character talking about the war, how they feel about it. And I think it was rather a remarkable document, if I can be so immodest. I can be so immodest because a lot of it was improvised. A lot of what the actor said was not written for them. They came up with it themselves.
You left MASH after 4 years. You left in 1976.
Right.
Why did you leave? The show was really popular.
Well, I had given it my best and my worst and everything in between. I just felt it was time to move on. I mean, mm-hmm. It was getting too easy and too hard at the same time. Do you know what I mean? I didn't want to fall back on cliches of my own. I didn't want to. I was desperate to keep it fresh and interesting to me so that it would be that way to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't sure I could do it anymore.
You've written a lot of drag humor over the years. You co-wrote Tootsie.
Yes.
Of course, Klinger was in drag during a lot of MASH.
Yes.
And there's some drag humor in Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum.
You can see how far drag humor goes. That you know that was taken from, you know, the convention that began
in ancient Rome.
Day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So mm-hmm. you mean what's the attraction for me?
Well, you know. So what's so funny about? I mean, we've all laughed, but analytically, which I figured you might analyze this as a writer. Analytically, what's so funny about a man in a dress, particularly if it's like a straight man in a dress?
I don't know. I'm sitting in front of a mirror now in the dress, and I don't think it's very funny. I think it's very attractive. what's funny is it just knocks the props out of any kind of ridiculous masculine ego. It just lets us be, because it's just such a reversal of what we think we are and what we hope to come off as. I mean, that's not a very scholarly response, but I think that's going to have to do.
Larry Gelbart will be back with us on the second half of our show. On January 28th, the Writers Guild of America will pay tribute to him. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Something expensive, something offensive, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Passions and potions, constant commotions, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with kings, nothing with crowns, bring on the lovers, liars and clowns. Old situations, new complications, nothing portentous or polite. Tragedy tomorrow, comedy tonight. Something convulsive, something repulsive, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something aesthetic, something balletic, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Nothing with gods, nothing with fate, weighty affairs will just have to wait. Nothing that's formal, nothing that's normal. No.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Larry Gelbart. Also, Ron Popeil's Golden Oldies, TV's most famous salesman, tells us about the early days marketing such inventions as the Vegematic, Kitchen Magician, the Smokeless Ashtray, and Mr. Microphone. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD by Cecilia Bartoli. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Larry Gelbart. In the 50s, he wrote for Sid Caesar. He went on to develop the TV series MASH and to write many of the episodes. He also wrote the screenplays for Oh God, Tootsie, and Barbarians at the Gate. Your family moved to Hollywood when you were a kid. And
yes.
Your father was a barber.
My father is a barber
still. Is still a barber. Wow.
89 years old and still barbering.
Where? Out of his home or barbershop?
Beverly Hills. My father has the rare distinction of having been a barber to both JFK and Harry Ruby.
Wow. Harry Ruby, the songwriter Harry Ruby?
No, Harry Ruby. Jack Ruby, excuse
me. Oh.
Jack Ruby. And his son has the rare distinction of having Alzheimer's before his father. Jack Ruby, who of course shot Lee Harvey Oswald.
Wow. Well, yeah, okay. When the family moved to Hollywood, your father started cutting the heads of movie stars like Edward G.
Right.
Robinson, Gregory Peck, George Raft. How
yep.
did he become barbered to the stars?
Well, we were living in L.A. in Hollywood, and it just happened that the shop where he finally was able to practice his trade was heavily populated with named people. It was called Drucker's Barbershop in Beverly Hills, above a very exclusive men's haberdashery called Jerry Rothschild's, and all these people came in there. All of them from from the stars to other stars, to gangster stars, Bugsy Siegel, Mickey Cohn, people like that, and presidents.
The story of your father cutting the hair of celebrities, I think, segues perfectly into the story of how you became a professional comedy writer. So let me let you tell the story.
Well, one of my father's clients was Danny Thomas. We are now, of course, talking about 45, 46. No, before that, 43. And he told Thomas that Thomas was appearing on a radio show called the Fanny Bryce Maxwell House Coffee Time. For younger audiences, Fanny Bryce was the woman that Barbara Streisand portrayed in the show Funny Girl. And for even younger audiences, Barbara Streisand is the mother of Jason Streisand, Jason Gould. At any rate, my dad, quite on his own bat, because I had never, ever, ever thought of writing as a living or even something I could do, writing comedy. I was the typical sort of high school show-off who put on plays and whether it was in the auditorium or in the geography or history class, I was always cutting up, mostly to cover up the fact that I had not done my work. But anyway, he said to Thomas, "My son is very clever. Would you like to have him write something for you?" And Thomas said, "Sure." I mean, what did it cost him, And so I wrote some material for him, and Thomas was impressed enough to pass me along to the head writer of a show, a man named Mac Benoff. Then Mac put me to work on the staff. I was 16.
Do you remember anything you wrote for him?
I remember a joke, because I remember standing in the control booth again and hearing it read by an actor at a microphone and having an audience laugh. And that was the first time that ever happened to me. I don't know what the buildup was. Someone who was being charged with some heinous crime, and the punchline, the man at whom these charges were directed, said, "I said I was sorry." I mean, I know that doesn't sound funny now. But that was the joke. Look at that. It's still getting a laugh.
I
feel like Plautus. And that was the joke. And I remember, all these years that was my first taste of this kind of reaction.
So you worked in radio in the last days of the radio variety show.
I guess they were the last days. I was in radio from 43 or 4 until about 1950. Yeah, I guess those were the last days.
Yeah, by then people were making the transition to TV and moving their shows into television.
Yes.
And you even worked on Duffy's Tavern.
That was my college, yeah. 2 years.
Yeah, describe that show for people who never heard it.
Duffy's Tavern was an imaginary tavern. It was a radio show, of course, as we said. It had a bartender named Archie. It had a few running characters, and every week it was visited by some a star. It could be a star of movies. It could be a star of the opera world. It was a very cultured show. And it was a show that treated language as its chief source of comedy, as opposed to, say, insults or almost any other form of comedy. It really was written for the ear, contained a great many spoonerisms. Malapropisms were the chief tool of the show. And it was just, I say it was my university, because in those 2 years, I think I learned more than perhaps I've learned since about writing comedy.
Where did you learn jokes?
My father always told jokes. My earliest recollections are, you know, getting laughs as a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, being told, you know, tell him the joke about the baba bum, you know, which I'd already heard. And, you know, and my mother was wickedly funny on her own, not jokes, just her own humor. She had a real sharp, biting sense of humor. And needless to say, I don't think it came through my mother's milk, but I mean, as soon as I could understand, I think I understood that what she was saying was funny. And I don't know whether I was meant to emulate her or whether I thought that that's the way you dealt with life, that you used humor.
Larry Gelbart recorded last summer. Coming up, Dicing and Slicing with Ron Popeil. This is Fresh Air. Thanksgiving is not just Turkey Day. It's the official kickoff of the Christmas shopping season. My guest has tried to sell you gifts for mom, your spouse, and your kids. And, of course, he wants you to buy his products for yourself, too. More specifically, you've seen him on TV, where he's hawked the Vegematic, the Popeil Pocket Fisherman, the Smokeless Ashtray, and Mr. Microphone. Yes, it's Ron Popeil. Sure, you may have laughed at how tacky his ad sounded, but they made him a millionaire several times over. Now he gets to stretch out in the more leisurely format of the infomercial, where he sold his hairspray to fill in bald spots. Here he is demonstrating his food dehydrator.
Over here, we got we're drawing strawberries and cantaloupe and honeydew and watermelon, and we can do papaya. Yes, you can dry watermelon with the machine too, seeds and all.
Look at this!
Yeah, the only key thing here is slice your food thin. That's the key thing for making this machine really work with high performance. Slice the food, and here we're drying watermelon, we've done papaya, mangoes, cantaloupe, honeydew.
Look at the strawberries. Are strawberries dried
wonderful? You know what you use that for? You take those sliced strawberries, throw them on some yogurt or cereal in the morning. Absolutely delicious.
Ron Popeil isn't shy about selling his products or himself. His memoir is called Salesman of the Century. It's just been published in paperback. He learned to sell by demonstrating products at flea markets and at Woolworths in the 1950s. I asked him what he sold there.
Oh, lots of products. I sold a plastic plant kit that was artificial foliage was a big thing in the 50s. And we developed a product that came out of a tube. It was called Plastisol. It was green in color. You can have it white in color. And we had these little molds that were aluminum of different shape leaves, like ivy, philodendron, nephritis. I learned all those things. And you could just take the Plastisol, put it in this mold, put the mold on top of a toaster or a electric burner, drop a cloth wire in it, and make a leaf in a minute's time. And after you made a bunch of leaves, I learned how to put the leaves together and make it into a plant. Put the plant in a pot, and you had a beautiful artificial foliage.
When you were demonstrating on the street or at Woolworths, what were your demonstrations like? Would you do one for us verbally?
Well, I can't do one without the product in front of me. But most of the products were housewares-type products, like food choppers and slicers and things of that nature. And I would normally say, if I was chopping onions, I would say, Or using my food slicer, I would say that the food slicer blade was so sharp that you could slice an onion so thin it only had one side. Or when tomatoes got expensive in the wintertime, you could slice a tomato so thin you'd make one tomato last you all winter long. Or this knife was so sharp that you could cut a cow in half, and that's no bull. We had wonderful lines that we developed a long time ago. Every demonstration basically was showing the consumer the old-fashioned way of doing it, whether we had an old rusted knuckle buster in the house.
Like a cheese grater or something. Yeah,
one of those old knuckle busters. It was a stand-up kind of product versus using my particular product that accomplished the same thing very easily, easy to clean, and the price was right.
Now, the first item you advertised on TV was...
a product called the spray gun, the Ronco spray gun.
And what did it do?
Most folks remember it. It was, remember the nozzle, any nozzle that fits on the end of a garden hose, but this was gun-shaped, and it held a tablet, a soap tablet to wash your car or second-story window, a wax tablet if you were doing your car, and then we added a fertilizer tablet, a weed killer, and an insecticide tablet. And the water passed this chamber that held the tablet. And, of course, if you had a soap tablet, soapy, forceful water would shoot out. You could turn off the chamber so that water would pass directly passing the tablet without picking up any of the tablet, so you'd have a rinsing effect. I made that commercial. In fact, I was working in a Woolworth store in Chicago, and a friend of mine told me that I could, in fact, and, of course, it's in my book, The Salesman of the Century. How...
Oh, Salesman just got the book title in.
Oh, yep, that's one. Didn't expect me not to do that. Told me that I could make a commercial, a TV commercial down in Florida at a television station for $550. Within 1 week, I was on a plane down there, and I made the commercial for $550. I used a friend's house, my friend's car, and the product was overwhelmingly successful.
It sold.
It sold, yes.
Okay, now the second ad you did on TV was for the Chop-O-Matic.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, why don't we hear the ad?
If you want to chop a few celery stalks, you know, for soup, salad, or stuffing, instead of wasting time cutting the celery with a knife like you usually would, just place your celery under the chopper with a few taps of the palm of the hand. See how easy it is? Just like bouncing a ball, and in seconds your celery is chopped. Here's a way to make a hurry-up supper. Make some of those mouth-watering hash brown potatoes. Just place the potatoes under the chopper, a few taps, a few seconds, and there's your hash brown. They're ready for the pan. What could be easier? Of course, if you have an appetite for potato pancakes, you just continue tapping. I'll show you pancakes that are so fine, they won't fall apart or be tasteless or rubbery as when you grate them. And just look how fine they are. You add an egg and some onion and fry them to a golden brown. This is certainly a welcome sight for any hungry man.
Now, I have to say, your voice on that ad almost sounds like a circus barker. There's a certain
yes.
kind of melodious, you know, mm-hmm. the way you're asking questions and then answering them. It sounds like you're inviting people into the tent or something.
Well, when in fact you are demonstrating product, there's so much you have to say and people are in a hurry. Don't forget, people who stopped to buy my product didn't come to see me to buy the product. They were there to buy something else. What we had to do, or what I had to do, was stop them, create an interest, and have them go down in their purse or pockets and take out money and buy a product they had no interest in buying in the first place.
Now, where did the Chop-O-Matic come from?
Chop-O-Matic was developed by my father. My father was an inventor of consumer products. Most of his products, your listener would be aware of, the Veg-O-Matic was his invention. I did the television marketing on it. Chop-O-Matic was another one, and of course, the big one, Veg-O-Matic, was a very big item for him. But he used to use me as his, although I didn't work for him, I was one of his biggest customers, and he used to use me to sell his product, and he would send down his customers to watch me work, whether it be at a flea market, of which at those days was Maxwell Street in Chicago, or the Woolworth store. And I was always have his customers in my audience watching me sell tons and tons of product, watching this money change hands. And he developed a lot of customers that way.
Now, the Chop-O-Matic you were selling back when this ad was made, which was, what, the 1960s sometime?
Early 60s, yes.
Okay, you're selling it for $5.98, but for this TV presentation, order right now, $3.98, and a special bonus, a valuable recipe book with 50 secret recipes
by world-famous chefs.
Yes.
Right.
Now, how does this work? You know, it's $5.98, but if you order now, it's $3.98. Were you really selling it for $5.98 and knocking off a couple bucks
in some places?
For TV?
I don't think that's much difference today than what everyone is aware of what is the suggested retail price.
Mm-hmm.
The suggested retail price is a price that car manufacturers use. We use it in our business. And we do, in fact, sell a lot of product at that price. But we all know that the suggested retail price is a price that you can come down from. And everyone wants to buy something for, quote, less than retail. And so it's a deal. And we even go beyond that by giving some other goodies away with it. We'll add on some other ancillary products.
What's the most successful TV ad you've ever done?
I would think it's misleading because of the medium, and that's because of the infomercial business. And the food dehydrator is about $200 million in sales in the past 4 years.
Okay, now let's leave out the infomercials. What's the most successful?
Then I would have to think that, are you going to talk about dollars or units? Because if you go back 40 years, then...
You got me there, units.
Units. Units, I would say Vegematic. Then Mr. Microphone. Then the smokeless ashtray. Then the Ronco clean air machine. Those items were big. Buttoneer was a giant item as well. The problem with buttons is they always fall off. The problem with buttons is they always fall off, and when they do, don't sew them on the old-fashioned way with needle and thread. Get a buttoneer. The new automatic button fastener makes a great Christmas gift.
Now, this is part of your philosophy, right, that every product needs to respond to a problem, needs to be the solution to a problem.
That's in most cases. There was one exception in my life, and that was Mr. Microphone.
One of your inventions?
Yes.
Actually, I'm going to pause here and play a Mr. Microphone ad.
Hey, this Christmas party is getting a little too quiet. I think it's time we liven it up with my favorite Christmas gift, Mr. Microphone.
Hey, what's that?
Well, you set the dial on your FM radio and testing.
These kids are having a fabulous time with Mr. Microphone, the cordless microphone that actually puts your voice on the radio. There are no attaching wires, so you're free to move around. Broadcast over any FM car radio.
Hey, good looking. We'll be back to pick you up later.
Now, that hey, good looking, were you being funny or serious there? Did you really expect people would go cruising along with their Mr. Microphone picking up chicks?
I thought that it would be used for that purpose. And I thought people would find it very, very unique and remember it. And I was right.
Now, why did you invent Mr. Microphone? I mean, what was on your mind when you invented Mr. Microphone?
I think I had come in contact with some people who were talking about their grandchildren. And they were talking about how their, one was a grandson and a granddaughter. And they were talking how they had great voices and they were going to be singers. And I guess singing in them was big time for children, or as perceived by grandparents or mothers. And then I know that I had occasionally, when I was taking a shower, would sing in the shower and get that echo. I said, well, maybe there's something really here. And this was an electronic toy. It could be made very inexpensively. And for those out there listening that didn't know what a Mr. Microphone or how it worked, basically it was just a microphone, well-designed, had an orange top, black handle, had a little wire sticking down about a foot long. It was cordless and wireless, and you could turn on any FM radio in the world to 88.3 on the FM dial, and you could hear yourself coming through the radio. So the product not only had domestic use here in the United States or Canada, but all over the world. And it was inexpensive to make, and people remember the commercial. It was just a great, great holiday gift.
Ron Popeil recorded last winter. His memoir is called Salesman of the Century. Coming up, a new CD by Cecilia Bartoli. This is Fresh Air. One of the brightest stars in opera today is the young Italian coloratura mezzo-soprano, Cecilia Bartoli. She's best known for performing music by the composer the American mezzo-soprano Marilyn Horne excelled in, Rossini. Bartoli's latest album, though, is neither opera nor Italian, but French songs of the 19th and 20th centuries. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
If good German lieder singing is a rare commodity in the world of classical music today, the art of the French song is even rarer. Even in France, there's a scarcity of great interpreters of the national heritage. The requirements are demanding. French music tolerates not a soupçon of sloppiness in tone or diction. But within that elegance lies a range of emotions that includes passionate importunity, sly insinuation, and a crucial element of self-dramatization. Now, with this delightful new release by Cecilia Bartoli, called appropriately and inevitably Chant d'Amour, we have another outstanding interpreter of the French chanson. When you see her on TV, you can see her vivid facial expressions, sometimes almost too broad in close-ups. Perhaps more so on this album than on any of her previous recordings, she makes us see her face in the sound of her voice. As in the uninhibited version of Bizet's setting of Victor Hugo's poem La Coccinelle, the poet is looking back at his own teenage foolishness. He remembers flicking a ladybug off a pretty girl's neck instead of using it as an opportunity to kiss her. The ladybug tells him, "Animals are the good lords, but stupidity is man's." And he sighs with regret. Bartoli's French album includes a wide range of songs by Bizet, Delibes, Berlioz, and a marvelous Ravel group that includes folk-like songs in Spanish, Italian, Greek, Hebrew, and even Yiddish. And one song without any words at all that she also fills with character. She's lucky in her accompanist, the prize-winning pianist and conductor Myung-won Chung, who is both supportive and full of color. I love the way he suggests the stream that will pull poor Ophelia under its rippling surface in Berlioz's great Shakespeare song, The Death of Ophelia. The novelty on the album are three delightful songs written by the 19th century diva Pauline Viardot, who created the role of Delilah in Saint-Saëns' Samson and Delilah. She was the sister of the even more famous opera star Maria Malibran, and for many years was the object of the Russian novelist and playwright Turgenev's infatuation. Here's the opening of Viardot's version of a poem by Alfred de Musset that Delibes also set, about the flirtatious daughters of Cadiz. Bartoli's French, like all her other languages besides Italian, is translucent, if not absolutely idiomatic. There are a few moments when her dramatic impulse goes too far, and sincerity slips across the border into melodrama. But her recorded voice has a lovely warmth and impressive flexibility, and in this dry stretch for art songs, Bartoli's irresistible vitality is an especially welcome oasis.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new album of French songs by Cecilio Bartoli on London Records. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Roberta Shurrock, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Barbara Bogave. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant, technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. I'm Cherry Gross. Happy Thanksgiving from all of us at Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Pistols, a collection of Robert Mapplethorpe's flower photographs. This is NPR, National Public Radio.